Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to the landmark milestone 50th episode of NML Crossing, where today we're going to be wrapping up our first actual story arc of No Man's Land proper. Looking forward to this. Been looking forward to it for a long time. Because this has been a great story so far, but once we're through it, that means we're heading back into Azrael Town for two episodes in a row. Not sure. It's weird. I'm kind of looking forward to that because it's just so damn silly. But at the same time, I gotta try to think about things to say about it, which proved to be very difficult last time and might be even more so this time. Now, if you are listening in real time, this episode, if all goes according to plan, will be dropping on a Sunday. Now, I don't usually do episodes over the weekend. I tried to stop myself from going crazy. Back when I was doing the daily thing, it was just nonstop, as, you know, daily might imply. But this weekend's a little different. I believe it's also going to be, it's Easter. Today, if you're listening on the day this came out, it's Easter. So happy Easter to everybody. But here at the house, we're still in the throes of the move, and the wife and I are kind of in a negative feedback loop. Both of us have been traumatized by moves in the past, and this one is just another to the pile. And neither of us are having a good time. Nothing feels comfortable. Nothing feels real. It's just a real ugh time here at the house. So what do you do? What do you do? You go to what makes you comfortable. And I guess what makes me comfortable is talking to myself in a room. So here we are. Now, I don't want to go too deep into it, so I won't. We'll just hop into today's book, which is Detective Comics number 730, had a March 1999 cover date. The story's called No Law and a New Order Part 4, Language. Written by Bob Gale, pencils Alex Maleev, inks Wayne Boucher, colors Dave Stewart, letters Willie Schubert, edits Illich, Gorfinkel, Vincenzo O'Neill, cover price $1.99. And we open in the all-new, all-different Batcave, also known as the Gotham City Sewer. Now here, Batman and Alfred are discussing the former's new back-to-basics approach and debating the tact of engaging in vandalism in order to leave his mark on No Man's Land. Now Batman says the tagging is the new language of Gotham, and, well, he's got to learn to be fluent in it. We next follow Batman into the night, where he proceeds to mark some territory. He talks about how different No Man's Land is at night from how it was BQ. And he also raises some points about how the place smells, which, yeah, it's some of those inconvenient things about No Man's Land. The scents are a delicate blend of garbage and poop, basically. So, not great. Not great. I think he says something along the lines of it would take like multiple tidal waves and hurricanes to wash the stench away. So, that's pretty gross. We jump to the next morning, where the Blue Boys happen across a bat tag. Now, Jim Gordon, he sees it, and he ain't impressed. In fact, he's more than a little bit peeved by it. Now, he's sure that the tags aren't the Batman's doing, since, in his words, it's not his style. But he's also very annoyed that anybody would do it all the same, and he orders the bat tag and any bat tag to be painted over. Elsewhere, assumedly somewhere near Newtown, Lord Quakemaster and his goon squad happen across another bat tag. Scarface, who is now hooked on Zesty Cola, is infuriated. Now he orders one of his goons to send a message to whoever left the tag. And, while he isn't satisfied with the lazy line the goon spray paints through the bat tag, it's really a funny scene here. Maybe not funny, but it's funny. We got the bat tag, right? And we got this goon who just sprays a single line through it. Now, Scarface doesn't dig that, so he just shoots the goon dead. Another goon, named Rhino, he sprays the Lord S tag on the corpse's back, and then they leave him behind as a message. Now, we're going to get a lot of Scarface here. Scarface is going to be our big bad for this issue, and I guess ultimately for this opening story arc. Before the baddies get to going, Scarface calls out to the residents of this neighborhood, and he claims them as a new part of his territory. He threatens that he's got access to guns and ammo, and should any of the folks disobey him, well, they'll be killed. Now, he appeals to them. He says, "All I want to do is protect you." And he wants to protect the people and also drink zesty cola. That night, we rejoin Batman at the site of these two tags. Now, he sees the one that the GCPD painted over, and also the Lord S deal. We follow him into an apartment in Scarface's new turf, where he questions some dude about what's going on. Now, the dude is shocked awake by the bat, and as expected, he kind of freaks the F out. Batman tries to reason with the guy, assuring him that he's, you know, on their side. But dude ain't so sure. He says that Scarface protects them, and that outsiders are bad. Just then, one of Scarface's heavies bursts in the door and fires a single shotgun blast in Batman's direction. Our hero launches himself out a window and down to the street below. He's a little bit surprised that the heavy didn't follow up with a second shot, so surprised that it actually gives him an idea that we'll follow up on in a little bit. First, though, we retreat with Batman back into the sewers, where he checks in with Alfred about this latest recon mission. He sees how Scarface and the Ventriloquist can control their neighborhood, because there's no information outside of what Lord S delivers. No TV, no internet, not even radio. Batman sees taking the puppet down as the perfect opportunity to reestablish himself as a major player in the new-look Gotham City. He says that, in his absence, the myth of the Batman has been neglected. Out of sight, out of mind, all that jazz. Next, we pop back over to Lord S for a beat. Now, the heavy from before reports that he ran into the Bee. Scarface orders Rhino to give the guy a reload, which winds up confirming a suspicion that Batman had about how much ammo these goofs are packing. More on that in a little bit. But first, Batman checks in with Oracle. Now, she doesn't actually have all that much in the way of novel information. She refers to herself as a high-tech girl in a low-tech world. Batman breaks off communication before she can parlay into some don't stop believing. Back to Batman, where he considers more about what he knows about Wesker, and he deduces that people only kowtow to him because he controls the bullets. And so he decides to go undercover as a hoodlum in order to make contact. Next thing we know, a beanie-wearing Bruce Wayne is looking down the business end of a Lord S heavy. Now, he's there to offer a trade. One refreshing zesty cola for, well, at the end of the day, information, I guess. The heavy threatens to just shoot him and take it, to which Bruce plays off his hunch, referencing the fact that this guy has only got one bullet. Now, the heavy doesn't even bother to lie. He's just like, "How did you know I only got one bullet?" The heavy then offers Bruce some cigarettes for the soda, and our guy bargains him up to a working lighter. Bruce then asks for some info on Lord S's racket in Newtown. And dude ain't shy about spilling the beans. Yeah, they basically use the residents as labor, and for all their hard work, they're given dog food. Great. Now, they keep in line because Lord S offers protection, or he promises protection. Bruce once again confirms that each of the heavies is only given one bullet at a time. The heavy then offers up that Scarface has 8 heavies, which Bruce didn't even ask about. Wow, did Scarface like confer with Nicholas Scratch before hiring his flunkies? Because these guys suck. Anyway, before parting company, Bruce says that he's got more zesty cola that can be his, only if he delivers a letter to Scarface for him. Now, the heavy takes the sealed envelope and immediately brings it to the big boss. Now, the letter says that the beanied Bruce has 1,000 rounds of ammo that he's looking to move or trade. And he says if the puppet's interested, to have some that same heavy wear a red armband the following day. And so, he does. It's worth noting here, Scarface does say bin, B-E-E-N, which has a B in it. Probably wasn't actually worth noting, just pointing out the error, I guess. The next day, Beanied Bruce sees the red armband and heads down to check in. He winds up surrounded, frisked, and finally brought to the feet of Lord S. Now, Bruce has four bullets with him in order to give the puppet as a sample. Scarface is a bit incredulous, wants to know why this drifter is giving him this offer. Bruce says it's a simple matter of logistical practicality. This ammo cache is nearby, and he doesn't want to risk lugging it across the entirety of No Man's Land to find another potential buyer. Bruce is brought to a supply room where Scarface offers him anything he can carry in exchange for that ammo. Bruce doesn't trust the puppet and proceeds to make his own demands. Now, he says the ammo crate will be left at the old Addison Street subway station, and he wants 24 flashlights and batteries. He also warns that he'll be hiding in the shadows with a rifle just in case Scarface and company try anything funny. Now, Scarface is getting cold feet. And so, Bruce shrugs it off and says he'll just trade everything over to Black Mask then. And, upon hearing that, Scarface decides to take the deal. The next day, Scarface and company arrive at that subway station where they happen upon the U.S. Army crate o' ammo. When they open it, a magnesium flare goes off, blinding them. There's also tear gas, which chokes them. Batman is nearby, wearing some protective gear. During the flashbang, he leaps into action, taking down all of Scarface's goons, and even snagging the puppet out of Wesker's mitts. He then forces the ventriloquist to say his name. And, well, he does. He actually says Batman. He then makes him say that Batman's in charge, which he has no problem doing. He says, yes, Batman's in charge. Cool, cool, cool. He then ties all the baddies up and leaves them for Alfred to watch, before heading topside in order to rebirth the myth of the Batman. Once up there, Batman uses a megaphone in order to alert the Newtowners that he's now in charge. Now, he's actually doing this in order to draw out some of Scarface's remaining men, who are there, they take aim, and fire. Batman is shot, and he goes down. Moments later, however, he stands back up. You see, he was banking on Scarface not using armor-piercing bullets. A risky gamble indeed, but one that apparently paid off. Now, this turns out to be more than enough to win the day. The Batman is back, the Batman is pissed, and the Batman cannot be killed. The Newtowners all emerge from their ramshackle abodes to give tribute to their new leader and protector. To which, Batman is kinda taken aback. He's like, hey, you're all free, you know? You don't have to pay tribute to anybody. You're free now. But thing of it is, they don't want to be. Because freedom is scary in No Man's Land. They only want protection. And they want to be told what to do. Lord S's right-hand man, Rhino, shows up and appears to be actually quite reasonable. He tells Batman that this isn't about good or bad anymore. The only thing it's about is survival. And so Batman leaves Rhino in charge, but he says he'll be right back. We follow him back into the subway, where he lays out a proposal for Scarface's former goons. You see, they can work for him, or they can go with Scarface. You might be wondering, where is Scarface going? Oh, so were the goons. They ask where Scarface is going, and Batman says he's going to hell. Wesker freaks out a bit, which gets him a very satisfying-to-see backhand from the Batman. The goons are super quick to agree to Batman's terms, and so Alfred cuts them loose. We close out our issue and our story arc topside in Newtown, where Batman is holding court. He says Rhino's gonna be his proxy, and the people of Newtown, well, they're gonna get real people food now, not dog food. And as tribute to him, their leader, he gets first choice of goods and supplies that come in. And he vows that he will be around, keeping an eye on this neighborhood, to ensure that his will is being done, and that the residents are treated with kindness. And, well, if he sees anything he doesn't like, he's going to start taking fools out. And we wrap up the issue, and arc, with Batman spray-painting his tag over Lord S's. And that is where we leave it. Next time out, Asriel number 50. Now, before we talk about the issue here, we do have some letters here in Detective Comments. I think we have 1, 2, 3, 4 letters here. We're going to start with Dan via AOL, Now, he's talking about the contrast between Bruce Wayne and his neighbor, what's-his-face Davenport. You remember that guy? The guy who owned the Davenport building or the Davenport Center that fell down in the, I think it was the theater district. And he was being a real dick about having anybody move his building because he was just going to re-erect it somehow. And that ended with Batman driving a bulldozer through it to clear passage through because it was blocking roads through which, this is all pre-No Man's Land, of course, so goods and services could still, and protective equipment and rescue teams could all still pass through. Now, Dan, via AOL, says that he actually cheered when Batman drove that bulldozer through the downed Davenport building. And he says that Davenport himself is a character he loves to hate. And I tell you, I didn't know anything about this Davenport guy. My bat knowledge is sparse for the mid-late 90s, I guess. So he was a new guy to me. But I could definitely see him being someone you could enjoy rooting against. Dan also says that he is a huge Chuck Dixon fan. So I guess sorry about that since Chuck is not doing tech anymore. At least we still got him on Nightwing and Robin and eventually Birds of Prey. Next up, we got Martin via Hotmail. Hotmail is such a weird little, what would you even call it? Just an email service provider, I guess. But I remember the first time I saw that, probably in the mid-late 90s, I thought it was dirty. You know, Hotmail just sounds kind of dirty, doesn't it? Anyway, Martin, he loved the focus on Bruce Wayne during the Aftershock issues. He digs Bruce's relationship or friendship with Lucius Fox, and he hopes that Commissioner Gordon is eventually able to figure out the secret identity. He thought that the scene with Bruce renewing his vows at his parents' gravesite was cool, even though it happened like twice in 1 month. A little weird, right? We talked about how maybe the editors were busy working on No Man's Land itself to realize that they were repeating scenes in, two issues in a single month. Next up, we got Michael in California, who says he's been a Bat fan for over 30 years, but he thinks issue 725 of Tech was not only the best Batman Nightwing story, but perhaps the best overall DC comic story he's ever read. Part of me wants to say something pithy, but you know what? Anybody who loves a story as much as Michael in California does, God bless him, right? I wish I wasn't so cynical and jaded to where I can actually say that I loved a certain issue more than any other issue I've ever read. So, cheers, Michael. Next up, we got the GCPD at AOL. I don't think it's the actual GCPD, but they echo Michael's sentiments. They say Tech 725 was a masterclass as a standalone issue. Lots of lauding over Chuck Dixon's work here in this letters page, and a well-deserved lauding. And I gotta say, it's crazy that he wasn't as involved with No Man's Land proper as he could have and perhaps should have been. But those are our letters for this issue. How about we talk about the story we just read here? I tell you, I wrote this script probably, a long time ago. I've kind of, as is clear here, I've kind of fallen off since the move has happened. But I remember when I read it, I felt like this kind of came out of nowhere. I mean, I liked it. I liked it a lot. I thought it was a really good way to establish, or I guess reestablish, Batman's presence in No Man's Land proper here. But the whole ventriloquist Scarface thing felt like it was just, I don't know, it felt like it didn't get enough build-up. Not that it needed it, but it just kind of, I don't know. We're talking about like a 4-issue arc, and we wait until the final part to really, you know, push this ventriloquist thing. Then again, I mean, how much time do you really want to spend on the damn Quake Master, right? So maybe this was just, maybe it was perfectly paced here. I think Scarface makes a pretty good level one boss. You know, we don't want him to be the big bad. We don't want him to be the biggest bad, of course. So having him as the first domino to fall, I think that works. I think that works fine. I think that's probably Wesker's station, right? If No Man's Land was a video game, he'd make a perfectly fine level one boss, and it's exactly what they did here. I really liked the bit toward the end where Batman he gets shot, he gets up, everybody comes out to greet him and to pay him tribute, and it's something that he can't wrap his head around. He's not familiar enough with what this new normal is. He thinks by going in there and pronouncing that everybody's free is enough. Like, they're just going to take that and run with it and be like, oh, we don't have to be scared anymore. Only they do, because they're in no man's land. You know, Scarface sucks, right? But if it's a choice between being protected by an idiot with a puppet on his hand or being protected by nobody, you're probably going to want the puppet, right? You're probably going to feel more comfortable going to sleep every night knowing that there's a buffoon with a puppet there to protect you, controlling the ammunition, controlling the streets, making sure no outsiders can come in and hurt you. So that was really cool. I think that's something that we don't usually think about. You know, when the job is done, that's usually where our story ends, right? It's like the hostages are rescued, the bank robbery is foiled, and we just assume everything's just going to go on. But knowing that it's not here, I think that's pretty cool. It adds to the realism, it adds to the temporary permanence, if that makes any sense, to this story. I think it was just really well done. The GCPD didn't get much play this time, which was not so much disappointing, but a little bit surprising, considering how Gordon has pretty much been the star up to this point, at least of this story arc. So to only see them briefly was weird, but I think it worked, too. We got to see them react to the bat tag, and we're really building to something special here. The relationship between Gordon and Batman is going to come to a very dramatic head. We got a little ways to before we get there, but we got some very powerful, powerful scenes ahead of us, and I can't wait to get to them because they are really, really good. And they give insight, and they also kind of change the perception as to the relationship between Gordon and Batman, not only as men or as friends or as, I guess, partners in a way, but just the entire, I'm not quite sure how to word it, but it goes deeper than all that. And when we get there, it's going to be special. But I think that's probably all I have to say about this issue. I guess on a silly note, you know, we all kind of joke about how a pair of glasses isn't the best way to disguise the fact that Clark Kent is Superman. Here, we have a beanie separating Bruce Wayne from a common hoodlum, which is kind of funny. You know, of course, they wouldn't know he was Batman, but they might recognize Bruce Wayne, but apparently not. Oh, well. What are you going to do? Well, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to hop into the mailbag here. We got a few great letters to discuss. We're going to start with our friend Chris Yu, who says, I remember loving the mystery of who the new Batgirl was. Batman obviously knows who she is, and she obviously knows that he knows, but me as the reader had no clue. And you know, I was thinking about this. I also had no clue. You know, despite the fact that I read this after the fact, I didn't know. I really don't want to spoil it. I thought it was someone else. And then to find out that it was someone who I didn't expect was interesting. I'll leave it at that. Chris continues. The interaction between the cops is the high point of this issue for me. This first story of No Man's Land feels like Gordon's story more than Batman's. He knows he has to break police rules, but he's still trying to keep one foot on the right side of the line and not cross it altogether. He will always be a law and order cop at his core. Now, Pettit reminds me of the kind of cop who became a cop in order to crack some heads and not to serve and protect or uphold the law. Having friends and family in law enforcement, to me, he is a bad cop, but a good no man's land warrior. And that's true. That's very true here. And I think we talked about that last episode here, just how great this, the way they're deconstructing the GCPD here for this new normal. Gordon, he's willing to break some rules. He's willing to shatter some rules if it'll, you know, protect his family. But even he sees Pettit as being a little bit beyond the pale. You know, Pettit literally blew a guy's brains out in the third part of the story, which, like Chris puts it here, that's a damn good no man's land warrior, but not a good cop. Not someone you'd want to protect you. Not someone you'd want to protect and serve your family. Just someone you want to stay on the good side of because you just don't know what he might do. He's a scary, self-serving kind of guy who really seems to be getting his kicks here in no man's land. Chris continues, our discussion on the term graphic novel got me thinking. Did No Man's Land ever have a novelization? And guess what? It did. Written by Greg Rucka, no less. Plus, according to at least one review, it contains no Asriel. So I bought an old paperback copy. I plan to read it to see how it compares to the original comic story and what was left out for better or for worse. Going to wait until we get a little bit deeper into No Man's Land to start reading, so I have something to compare it to. And yeah, I knew about the novelization. I think I almost bought it years ago. I found it at a used bookstore for like a buck or two, and I had it, and I for some reason I didn't buy it. I also, I think it was like the same day or the same weekend I found the novelization. I think it was Roger Stern who did the Death and Return of Superman. Or maybe it was just the Death. I don't remember. But I remember I had both of them, and I was going to buy them, and I didn't buy either of them. But, you know, if you do start reading that, and it's something that we should include for the show, let me know, and I'd be happy to add it. I don't think it'd be too hard to find a copy, either in person or online. And I did read the reviews for it not too long ago and found out that they left out all the Asriel and Nick Scratch stuff, so... Is that a value added? Is that addition by subtraction? Or is that leaving out some vital, vital information for the No Man's Land story? Who knows? Who knows? Chris continues. For me, calling collections of issues originally released monthly a graphic novel works, as long as the entire story was laid out to be one complete story with a definitive beginning, middle, and ending. Watchmen is a graphic novel because Moore constructed for his one story into 12 chapters. Sandman is not a graphic novel because even though Gaiman knew what his ending was going to be from the very start, the entire middle was not known and meandered throughout various stories until he decided to tell his predetermined ending. Crisis on Infinite Earths is not a graphic novel because Marv Wolfman was constructing new story elements while the series was already being published. The All-Villains issue was not part of the original plan. Issues 11 and 12 were also not part of the original pitch. Now, those are all great points, and part of the reason why I love having these discussions, because I'm an easy guy to convince on some things. Not so much on other things, but when I'm confronted with sense, I will take it, and I will amend my position. And you know what Chris says, and we have another email coming up in a bit that'll continue this discussion. I could totally see Watchmen being a graphic novel because it was serialized, sure, but it was one story, 12 chapters long. It's still comics at the end of the day, and the traditional delivery system for that is single issues. So yeah, you know. I could come around to that. I could definitely come around to that. Crisis not being a graphic novel, I can agree with that as well. There's a lot more nuance and subtlety to our silly naming conventions here, aren't they? Chris continues. I'm reminded that many of the stories we consider classic literature were originally released in monthly chapters and periodicals before being collected into book form. Charles Dickens and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle both wrote serialized stories later collected into book form. A Tale of Two Cities and The Hound of the Baskervilles are both examples of this. So for me, graphic novels and trade collections are different things. It's hard to describe the difference to the uninitiated, but I know it when I see it. And that's very true. What got me, the way that everything is collected into trade now is, I think that's where my bugbears come up. I was looking at my shelves several years ago, and you know, you see all those, the things that every comic fan has, right? You know, all the Alan Moore stuff, the, you know, Crisis, all the things that are kind of drilled into us as being the essentials for your bookshelf, you know, Mouse, stuff like that. And then I look a little bit deeper and I have like Cable and Deadpool Volume 2. It's like, why the hell do I have that here? And does that even belong on the same shelves as a Watchmen or a V for Vendetta or a Kingdom Come? And it's weird the way we accept content now is so much different. I blamed a lot of it, or maybe blame is the wrong word for it, but I compare it to DVD seasons of television shows. You know, back in the day, you'd have, you look at your DVDs or your VHSs or whatever, and you'd have the biggies, right? You'd have like Star Wars, you'd have Jaws, you'd have all the Psycho, you'd have all the classic stuff. And then it got to a point where you'd have all the classic stuff, but like right next to it, you'd have Friends Season 3. And it just seems like they don't work. It just doesn't fit. I don't know. I don't even know where that tangent was going to. I apologize for that. But like Chris says here, you know it when you see it. Next up, we got a letter from our friend Professor Allen, who says, "Yes, we comics people can be very, very picky. Annoyingly so, one could say. I try not to get too hung up on the various bits of terminology. I don't think it's a clear line between collections and graphic novels, with a lot of overlap between the words. Mostly, I bristle at the idea that a key factor is the original format of the story, the idea that collections of issues cannot be graphic novels. My answer is that the works of Charles Dickens are called novels, even the ones that were first serialized in magazines. Of course they're novels. We don't give them a separate name. And in the world of modern science fiction, a number of novels are made up of connected stories that first appeared in sci-fi magazines. Again, we call them novels. Of course we do. I love these discussions. Thanks for providing a forum." And like I said, when I'm faced with sense, I can change my my point of view. You know, I knew about Dickens. Because wasn't the rib on the serialized Dickens that he was paid by the word, which is why the damn thing is so wordy. I knew about that, but I never even stopped to equate that with, you know, the medium that we are following here, with comics being serialized and collected, and how those might be considered a novel in a way, or just a collection of issues. It's weird, right? I mean, there's a lot to it. And like Alan points out here, we are very, very picky, annoyingly picky. I think with me, it's so much of my point of view is predicated in projection. Like when you hear the uninitiated talk about graphic novels, I was actually in a used bookstore. I'm in this used bookstore regularly. So one of my visits probably, I don't know, within the past 6 months. And there's a comics aisle where like everything is 50 cents. You know, it's random stuff. But like a couple aisles away is where all the trades are, or the graphic novel section as they have it. And I was there, you know, kneeled down, going through the stacks, you know, in the 50-cent area. And somebody walked through with their kid, and they're like, "Oh, yeah, you like comics?" And the kid's like, "No, I don't like comics. I like graphic novels." And he wanted to go look to see if they had any Gwenpool graphic novels. Meanwhile, I'm kneeled down and there are several issues of Gwenpool right in front of me that are collected in those quote-unquote graphic novels. I don't know. It just seems so weird. I remember it was Gwenpool because this is before I actually tried reading Gwenpool, and I had this knee-jerk dislike toward the character. Then I finally read some Gwenpool and I enjoyed it more than I ever expected to. But I don't know, that kind of got under my skin a little bit. And of course, this is just one teenager. You know, it's not indicative of much, but it kind of is at the same time because, I don't know, I feel like a whole generation doesn't take these single issues seriously. You know, they don't see them as having any, not so much financial value or monetary value, but just value in and of themselves intrinsically. And that hurts, you know? I mean, comics were where I went when I needed something to go to. And I'm sure a lot of people listening are the same way. You know, comics were our friends. Comics were our hobby. Comics is what we did, and maybe not so much what defined us, but it defined a part of us. They were home. And to see that kind of dismissed sucks. I mean, add to the fact that I find graphic novel to be kind of pretentious, just the term itself. I understand it. I'm cool with it. Just, you know, oh, I don't read comics. I read graphic novels. Just, come on, dude. Come on. Alan wraps up with, I think we should all just lighten up and enjoy our floppies. You almost got me there. Take care and be well. Thank you. Thank you so much for writing it, Alan. I really appreciate hearing from you. It's always a real treat when someone that I should be writing into writes into me. So thank you so much. Our final email comes from CJ, and this is a little bit of an older one. He's talking about Detective Comics number 729. And he's got a numbered list for us, which I love. He says, 1, listening to the NML bag today, it occurred to me that the Ra's al Ghul page from Mr. Wayne Goes to Washington arc might be touching on legacy, since he was part of that. It's still a flimsy connection, especially since I don't think that story arc led into the second generation of the contagion virus coming to Gotham, just threatening to get to Gotham. But the ghoul connection might be less flimsy than I originally thought. Still pretty flimsy, just a little less so. And that's true. That's true. It might be about legacy here, which we almost covered on this show. We almost covered it, since it is part of the government's rationale for cutting Gotham City off from the United States. But it could be. Could very well be that. And of course, they were talking about demons, and he is, you know, the demon's head and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I think that was just paying tribute to Denny. I don't know. Maybe not. Point number 2. I would disagree that you don't have the work ethic for narrative writing. You clearly put a lot of work in with podcasting and blogging, the type of work you'd need for narrative writing. I can see not having the desire to put that work ethic into narrative writing, but I think that's slightly different from not having it at all. I also think you should put your work on the same level of potential impact as narrative writing, since it's made more of an impact on me than many pieces of fiction. And that's something I really needed to hear. I was kind of throwing myself a pity party, I think, during the mailbag, talking about how much I respect folks who can create. You know, I don't consider what I do creation. It's transformative in a way, but it's, you know, to get a little bit waxy and poetic about it, we're, you know, standing on the shoulders of giants here, right? We're talking about stuff that other people made. I simply don't think I have the talent for much. I would love to write. I would love to draw, but I can't get past myself. I don't know if I've shared this here. I might have. I talk a lot. I've learned to tune myself out. You know, a lot of people get embarrassed about writing or drawing because they don't want other people to see their work. You know, it's like, oh, I don't want you to see how bad I am. For me, I don't want me to see it. Like, if I draw something, I'm embarrassed that I see it. Does that make any sense? Probably not. If I write something, it's like I get embarrassed that I see it, that I read it. And it stopped me from doing so many things I wanted to do. I mean, I'm 44 years old. I told myself when I was 24 that if I didn't have any writing done by the time I was 25, I would give it up. And 25 came and went. And I kind of just gave up. Said it wasn't happening for me. You know, that voice is still there. That want is still there. The ideas are still there. It's just, what is it? The brain is willing, but the flesh is weak. Is that what they say? Or the flesh is willing, but the brain is dumb. One of those things. It's hard. It's hard. So anybody out there who creates has my utmost respect and admiration. And I'm very, very jealous of you. CJ continues. As someone who could be pretty self-depreciating myself, I play down my work and accomplishments somewhat like you do, but I think we both can take more credit for the good work we do. The times others, including myself, have used your work as a resource shows that it's very valuable, not to mention just listening for entertainment. So I think some pride is called for. Not hubris, excessive pride, of course, but some pride to properly own your accomplishments. Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, thank you. That means a lot. And I'm kind of in a very wibbly state right now, if it's not abundantly clear. So yeah, this one's hitting a little bit harder than I thought it would. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I think that's all I can say, is thank you. I really needed to hear that. But speaking of things I need to hear from you. If you feel like writing in, I would invite and encourage you to do so. You can find me all those different ways. Chris is on infiniteearths.com, chrisandreggie.podbean.com, weirdcomicshistory@gmail.com, and all the social media places that everybody's at. I'm there too. And on that note, I would like to thank you all so, so much for sharing some of your day with me today. As I think this one's going up on a Sunday, which is weird. And it's going up on Easter Sunday, which I'm guessing most people will hear it on Monday, either way. Whatever the case, I truly appreciate you spending your time with me more than words can say. And until next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya. Makes it harder to think straight.